Philadelphia International remains open, flights are being delayed, and people are advised to call the respective airlines for further information. Superintendent Albert Williams did tell me that U.S. Air, formerly called Allegheny, had to stop their flights this morning, but they are back operating right now. So as we look at the coming rush hour, if you don't have to drive, stay put. If you do, use extreme caution. And the best bet is using rail transportation, either the subway or Conrail. Terry?
Thanks, Carlton. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll be hearing about how the snow has affected the Delaware Valley on 91 Report this evening at 6:29, right after All Things Considered. Well, it's 5 minutes after 4 o'clock now. Tuesday is Christmas, and today is the fifth day of Hanukkah. It's a time of year when, if you're a Christian or a Jew with even the slightest bit of religious activity, you have to ask yourself how, if at all, you're going to celebrate or observe the religious part of the holidays. It's a time when there can be disagreements within families over how the holidays should be observed, and it's a time when some people feel very guilty for not observing the holidays in the tradition that they were brought up with. Since this is a time when religion is faced head-on, I've asked two people to join us to talk about how they relate to and practice their own religions. With me is Reverend Ralph Moore, director of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus. He's a priest of the Episcopal Church and joins us fairly frequently here on Fresh Air. Also with us is Rabbi Meir Seligman of Temple Shalom of Broomall. This is a Reform temple in Broomall. As you can tell, they're both religious, but they also both observe their religions in pretty non-traditional, personal ways. Ralph, Mayor, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you,
Tara.
If I asked you, are you a religious person, how would you respond to that, Ralph?
I would say yes. I would be aware of the fact that the questioner might have a different view of religion than I do, however. So perhaps I would answer with a question asking, what do you mean by religion? What do you mean by religious? And after we got into a discussion, I would probably try to reveal the fact that I am happily exploring the faith tradition in which I was raised and am trying to experience my sense of being on a spiritual journey within that religious tradition and then take it from there. But I certainly would not try to run away from the fact that I am Christian and ordained in the Christian church, and I'm trying to make something creative of all those pieces of reality.
Mayor, if I asked you that question, are you religious, how would you respond?
Well, I guess I would respond first, Terry, by making a distinction between being religious and observant, because I think many people do think that being an observant Christian or Jew is synonymous with being religious. I share much of what Ralph said, changing some of the categories and the terms around. That's why we're brothers. I would say that for me, being religious involves the sensitivity to three questions. Who am I? And that question of identity might take someone to God. Number two, what is the purpose of my life? And number three, what is the meaning to life in and of itself in the face of death? Any individual who is caught up in the search for those answers, or who is sensitive to the questions, or who has had answers and who's lost them and is now searching again, is for me a religious person. The degree to which a person observes rituals, to the extent that that enhances the search, then the individual combines both the religious and the observant.
So I think you just answered what I was going to ask you next, and that is, what do you get from religion? So from religion, you get answers to those questions.
Well, I'm not so sure that I get the answers, because in my own life I've had the answers, and at one time I thought they were going to be forever, and they turned out not to be. So the questions and the search, I would say, if I had an axe to grind about helping people understand religion, that it's not only the answers that count, it's knowing the questions and having the freedom to seek the answers.
I put it like that also. The answers are almost not possible in the way I conceive things, but being a part of a process of discovery and of growing from one phase to the next phase of understanding and consciousness, the traditions that I value are other people's answers in former eras, And they came to some conclusions, and those conclusions were passed on long enough that some symbols grew up and some rites and rituals that meant something to them as they were on their various searches. So I can get some vitality out of re-exploring those things. But I don't think I've gotten a single answer. I've gotten a sense of being hopeful about my search in the midst of that confusion.
Mayor, from what you said, I would say, well, gee, what you're doing is what any philosopher would say they're doing. But Ralph, you introduced into it the idea of ritual and observance, which is not something that a philosopher would include in what they do unless they were talking about spending a lot of time reading or writing.
Well, I guess so. It's clear that traditional religions are different from a lot of other things that human beings have done in that they've, through accretion, formed a lot of symbolic behavior that you'd call ritual. Although I would say that philosophers and everybody else have rituals and symbolic behaviors and cults
and some philosophies are highly ritualized.
Yeah.
What's your relationship to your organized religion?
Well, tenuous, I would say. I'm not on the outs with my bishop, and I'm very happily involved in a parish, St. Mary's Hamilton Village, the Episcopal Church on the Penn campus, where I celebrate the Mass and preach occasionally, and I work in the ecumenical circles of the other Protestant denominations. I think that it's easier for a campus minister to exist the way I am able to move than it would be maybe for someone in a residential parish in a more traditional neighborhood. However, I have to do a lot of work in traditional settings, and I think that people recognize and look forward to those persons, not always clergy, in organized religion, who are pushing the frontiers. And I think that if it's done sensitively and with a certain amount of love and patience, that even the most radical thought or behavior that I would even think of pursuing could be interpreted within that understanding of my tenuous relationship with my tradition.
Mm-hmm. I do serve that kind of a parish,
yes,
that
here's
kind
a better
of congregation.
Testimony.
I operate with the principle, number one, that people cannot exist without institutions, and that I see my role in our congregation as trying to help, along with our lay leadership and our membership at large, to shape an institution that is humane and responsive to human and individual needs. I have a commitment to have a temple that manages, in the finest sense of the word, human diversity. And that's the fun that I have. I have a low threshold toward claustrophobia. So just as Ralph indicated, most of my understanding of Judaism and my roots within my faith process me to keep stretching out the walls, to keep pushing out so that, as we have within the Jewish tradition, ideas that were not acceptable and sometimes considered heresies, when one looks a couple of hundred years later, they are in fact the norm. I have no way of knowing other than what I feel God wants me to do, and if that's what I feel and am comfortable with that, then I have no choice but to live my life that way.
What kind of congregation do you have? Ralph works with students who tend to be more open to different ways of thought, to non-traditional approaches.
On the Penn campus, we have some 95-year-old students also whose mentalities are not quite there, too.
Yeah.
But that's an important answer to get from Mayor.
Our congregation, we have around 325 families in our congregation. Median age, I would say, is about 40, 42, around my age. We have in our religious school about 300, 320 children. And basically, we have people who are early middle age, we have a lot of younger families, and we have a growing number of senior citizens. So my response is to each of them individually, to each of their families, in terms of helping them realize the best they can within their own families, and then to other people who would come in off the street who'd want to talk with me.
Mm-hmm. What have you rejected, do you think, from the religion, and what are some of the things that you feel or believe that a lot of other people in your religion would find really ludicrous or unacceptable?
Well, for me, first of all, the literacy of the Bible had to go, and that's a very traumatic experience for a Christian born above Southern Baptist father and a Disciples of Christ mother, raised in a fairly conservative atmosphere. And I did that during the college years, which is a fairly on-schedule way to deal with that. But I stayed in the church and have always had to then face the fact that there are still enormous numbers of people in organized religion who believe literally in the Bible. But that, for me, is not a problem anymore. For a Christian, I've had to deal with the virgin birth. That is not a problem for me. The physical resurrection of Jesus Christ is not a problem for me. And now,
how do you deal with that, on a metaphorical level or
symbolic and an experiential level? I mean, the idea of resurrection, which that symbol arouses response in, you know, is something which is very exciting to me. And therefore, I can go through the rituals which are based upon that in a participatory way, and I can try to communicate that. So it's more than just metaphorically. It is experiential.
Maybe you should explain what you mean by that.
Because I can see through the life and death situations in which I live, and which I know other people live, out of almost nowhere, and there I would say the mystery of God, comes rebirth or new life from
hope,
a situation.
Creativity, hope. Sure.
So, and I would say that is an enormously powerful symbol for me. Now, I'm going to have theological contests until I die with people who then would want to say, well, if you don't believe in the factual bodily resurrection of Jesus, then you really are heretically sealed out of the church. But that, I think, there's a lot of open discussion about those kinds of things. And as long as we can leave it open and not have to come to conclusions about those propositions, I feel okay. The one that I'm very much now experiencing is a happy release from the triumphalism of Christianity. That's one that I've felt for years, but I'm finding at least three or four other people who agree with me. That is that Christianity is not the last word. It should assume its place alongside the other traditions, like all the other religions. It has not been sent to save the world and should, you know, this whole missionary enterprise that's been based on it, which gave us 300 or 400 years of Western expansion and European colonialism, we can junk all that. Those are examples that I've had to deal with.
Mayor, what are some of your examples?
I don't know whether it was so much what I've given up as much as a change in, or a series of changes in my thinking and in my theology. I was not brought up as a Reformed Jew. I was raised in a very traditional home and belonged to a conservative congregation. And my earliest shaping experiences were those where it was a highly ritually observant home, and I went to synagogue very often, much more often than I wanted to, but that was part of my process of growing up. And then when I decided to enter the rabbinate, I could not think of becoming a Reform rabbi because Reform at that time had nothing but negative connotations for me. After a number of years of my own growing and maturing in the conservative dimension of Judaism, my need for individual autonomy really began to grab me. And I recognized through that process that I had to be a rabbi. I did not want to give that up, but I needed to find a framework within Judaism that would harmonize with my commitment to autonomy, and I became a convert to Reform Judaism, I guess, what is it, in 1963, 64, terrified about what I was going to have to give up. And what I found out was that I didn't have to give up anything, but what I did have to do was become responsible for my own religious behavior and become more responsible for myself. In many ways, I'd like to define the way I use the word tradition to you, Terry. There are two ways that one can do that. One can identify tradition in the concrete, specific acts, beliefs, and practices that have emerged within Judaism, or one can identify tradition as the historical processes of preservation, adaptation, and mutation that create the specifics. Mm-hmm. So I find myself a profound traditionalist in principle, though not necessarily a profound traditionalist in some of the specifics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know whether this is one that you had to give up somewhere along the line or reappropriate in terms of your answer just now, but I know the masculinity of God is certainly one I've had to deal with in recent years.
Yeah.
I've certainly had to struggle with that, and it's not a problem for me, but there's so much of this male-oriented stuff that is in the scriptures and in all of the rituals, and that's a painful one for me right now.
Why is it painful?
Because I have understood and I've experienced God in a very different way from the anthropomorphized, fixed, male figure, superior judge, all that stuff. I feel it's a very exciting thing to get in touch with this source of ground of being, energy, other words, which are much more interesting and really are existent all throughout the ages.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you here, Ralph. If you're talking about not an anthropomorphic he or she or being or anything.
Or I would say if we could say he, we have to say she also. Let's have an androgynous God, certainly not an asexual one.
Right.
A very sexual God is fine.
But if you're talking about some kind of energy force that isn't like specific in any in any form or embodied by anything, does it seem reasonable for you to think that you're describing the same thing through your religion that other people are describing through their religions? In other words, is there a conflict to you between the different ways of approaching what may or may not be the same kind of force?
Mm-mm. No, I think that we're all talking about that.
And Ralph and I have found that a very close kinship over the years that we've been together. Because I also do not see God, though I did at one time, see God anthropomorphically. And I've had different God concepts over the years in my own maturation and growth, but I see God now as a principle of unity and diversity. So that if I use the phrase, I am in the image of God, I look at my body, it's a skeletal system, it's a muscle system, it's a circulatory system, it's a urogenital system. I am a unity of diversity. In that way, I am modeled in the image of God, and I translate my life and my actions using that model. As what I see God as that principle of unity and diversity demands of me, and then I live that in terms of family life, in terms of institutional life. And also in terms of the notion of integrity, because unity and diversity operates with the premise of integrity. And that's how I function.
People who are involved in religion but who have redefined themselves, what religion is going to mean, redefine that for themselves, I think really have to face the question, well, do they want to be in that religion or not? Because if that redefinition is going to be a really serious one, maybe you don't want to be in the religion. Maybe you either want to form your own religion or have such a personal relationship to this abstract concept that it ceases to be a religion and becomes more of a philosophy or just a way of life, but not a religious thing. Did that ever enter your lives, that decision about whether what you're talking about was going to be a religious interpretation, a religious approach or not, and whether you're going to stay or leave your organized religion?
Each time I had my theological conflicts, what I discovered was that in principle, the validation for that theological contest was within Judaism. So therefore, each time it happened, I kind of said, my God, I have found something else, or I am adding something to Judaism. It may not be good for anyone else, but it's good for me, and if I see Judaism as a process, then I'm validated. I encourage a lot of this kind of questioning in our own congregation. That questioning generally is never identified as being religious. So to get people to recognize that a dogma is not the only way to be religious, accepting a dogma is not the only way to be religious, but to be frustrated with questions and to be really concerned about the double-edged sword gift of freedom, that, to me, is one of the most sacred and spiritual trips that anyone can go on.
I have that same feeling. And I guess I would put it the same way that Mayer has. I just never went outside of Christianity in my tripping around. I left various manifestations of it for a long time and, you know, self-consciously turned my back to it even. Mm-hmm. But I guess it was familiar to me. The materials were available to me. I knew them by heart. The furniture I was more flexible to play around with. And I'm very much looking forward to a more syncretistic future for myself, where I can experience more of some other faith traditions and faith perspectives. And I see not getting bored at all the rest of my life as I'm interested in other things. And yet I will still probably never forget that I'm a priest in the Episcopal Church or a Christian or something, but that really is secondary. It's a kind of the foundation that I'm building the house on or something.
And an openness to God's family from there.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, I have two guests. We're talking about religion and their own very personal interpretations of their religions. My guests are Ralph Moore, who was just speaking. He is a minister in the Episcopal Church. He is the director of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus. My other guest is Rabbi Meir Seligman of Temple Shalom of Broomall, which is a Reform temple. I remember about a decade, no, maybe two decades ago, a long time ago.
Yes, I remember
I guess it was Time Magazine or Life Magazine said God is dead, and everybody was mourning the fact that no one went to church and no one went to temple anymore. And organized religion seemed to be losing membership. And now it seems to be gaining membership again. A lot of young people are returning to their organized religions. A lot of older people are turning back towards religion again. I think in the society it's usually looked on as being a good thing when people go back to church or to their synagogue and a bad thing when they turn away from it. Do you feel that it's good or bad one way or another? Are you happy when people go back to their organized religion and sad when they leave it?
Yes, it's good and bad.
Amen. Sometimes leaving might be one of the healthiest moves a person can make, especially if a person has felt stifled, claustrophobic, or has been treated disrespectfully. The issue to me is with people coming back, what happens once they're back, and why did they come back? I see a lot of people coming back now because of a resurgence of some of the feelings of the 50s. I see people coming back, some with a great deal of worry and concern and anxiety, and somehow or other expecting that religion will provide an anchor in a maelstrom of change. I think that's fine, but I still feel an obligation to help people recognize that you can ride the change and you don't need an anchor in the maelstrom of change. So depending upon who the individual is and what his or her spiritual needs may be, that's the way I want to respond.
Yes, I sometimes on the campus, some of the more conservative students are very angry at me because I'm not riding on this crest, because there could be quite a popular Christian campus movement. Campus Crusade for Christ is quite strong, and InterVarsity Fellowship and the Christian Athletes and other movements. And now, of course, we have some of the cultic forms appearing. And a lot of people think that at the Christian Association, we should be now coming out with a more traditional form of Christianity to take advantage of all that. And we are really resisting that temptation because we think that that would short-circuit all of the possibilities that a choice for this expression of religion could grow out of an experience that really an individual has in enlightenment, in self-understanding, in connection with the outside world, in maturing, all a holistic experience. In other words, I'm going to jump out of the tradition for a second. You know, I really like the idea that when Buddha was asked, you know, what the supreme understanding of spirituality is, he just simply said to stay awake. And that's what the word Buddha means, to the awakened one. Well, I think that all of what I understand to be Old Testament and New Testament understanding has that same comprehension. Stay awake. Keep your eyes open, your ears open. Grow, stretch, all like that. Well, when I see a return to organized religion, which is not doing that, but in a sense closing up in it, whatever the religion is, then I want to resist that.
So you think it's possible to return to an organized religion and within that religion practice in the same way that people talk about cults? In other words, when people refer to cults negatively, they talk about becoming totally submissive and subservient to an individual, to a very rigid set of guidelines and dogma, and to submerging your own sense of truth and identity to that. And are you suggesting it's possible to go back to any organized religion,
sure,
Christianity, Judaism, and look for that same same authority so that you can be as submissive and as you would if you were joining what we call a cult group?
I would say using the branches of Judaism, Orthodoxy and Conservatism, in their finest sense, not in the negative connotation of cult, sure, that's what Orthodoxy and Conservatism provide. They say that your freedom is fulfilled by placing yourself secondary to the tradition. Reform, which I think is a wholly other breed of Judaism, says that you are the deciding factor as to how you will use the tradition, but you are not subservient to it. Now, I might add that we have many families in our congregation, individuals in our congregation, who find great nurturance and warmth and security in observance, and I encourage that. But I would also want to be encouraging, and am encouraging, of those who are on the frontier of faith. Many Jews who did not grow up in observant homes are on a frontier when they are going back to the tradition, when they are trying out for the first time rituals and holidays and customs that they never had before. I grew up with all of that. So what they are coming, what I call a coming back to, is as creative for them, which I would want to support and encourage, as I or others like me who are on the frontier want to look beyond the horizon to see what's coming in the 80s. So that, again, comes back to the notion of Judaism's strength is in its diversity, and I want to be able to unify that diversity to the extent that I can within an institutional setting called a temple.
Oh, I think what you're saying brings up the idea of how you're going to bring up children if you have children, you know, with the traditions or without the traditions. I know some people who are not at all religious, Christians and Jews, who are bringing up their children within certain religious rituals and structures because they feel real bad if they didn't give their children that. Like, you can't give your son a bris after it's too late, you know.
Some would say it would be never too late.
Well, all right, okay. But there's certain ceremonies that are supposed to be performed at a certain time, and a lot of people are afraid. Well, God, what if my kid grows up and they decide they really want to be religious, and I didn't give them the rudiments of that religion, and I've made it hard for them.
But you know what that's saying too. It is saying that there is something within them who are questioning and thinking about that has not taken them out of the fold of their faith. Because they wouldn't really think in terms of giving something to their child if they had value judged it as worthless themselves.
Yeah, but if it's coming out of guilt and second-guessing, what do you think?
Well, I think that I certainly wouldn't deny those as basic ingredients to religion at any time. But even if it is, then that still remains an issue that individual has to work through, and perhaps by providing that for the child, that may reopen a whole different way of looking at faith for the individual.
Have you noticed this, Ralph, people bringing up their children within a sense of ritual and structure, in part just to give their children something to rebel against if they want it? They can make the choice. If they were brought up within the structure, they can decide to either keep it or shake it.
I see it most creatively happening when people want their children to be part of some kind of church fellowship so that the children can have some sense of the diversity. I like that word, the understanding that all these other people are there doing this thing and are good people and are helpful people and nurturing people. And if something were to happen to the family here, these people would help and take care. And these all people come together and they do some prayer and they do some worship together. Now, in that sense, I see people saying, I want my kids to be involved in some kind of church or religious fellowship or spiritual community. I know it's forever, it's always been, you know, dropping the kids off at Sunday school and picking them up a couple of hours later out of some sense of obligation that they should have this kind of stuff. I don't see that happening very much right now. It's either one or the other. It's either nothing at all. No, that's a lot of rubbish, and I don't want my kids exposed to it. Or there has to be something here that maybe can give them something in the future. And I'll talk about my own children. I have a first-year college student and a 12-year-old. In the case of our oldest, actually our behavior toward both of them has been the same. We never, no matter, even when I was serving a parish in a community, there was never an insistence on our part that they be a part of a church school or do any of the behavior that they did not want to do. There were times that we went as a family to do things as a family, but I never made an insistence on confirmation. They both were baptized, but we made that choice. That's our tradition, that they don't... We take them into the household of faith, and then their decision goes in or out depending on their own freedom of choice. Well, the oldest son very early got into some very, very good self-understanding about life and love and philosophy and so forth, and he never did fix on the church. He liked our participation in the parish, but he never went any further. And he was very proud at one point in saying, I'm not a Christian anymore, you know, and rather, but he wasn't really hostile about it. It's just he got off into reading some stuff on Taoism and Zen, and but I don't have any fear whatsoever about what's happening to that boy. He's in great shape. Our youngest, 12 years old right now, is absolutely ferociously involved in confirmation classes and wants to be an acolyte on the altar every Sunday and is going gung-ho. And we have not treated him any different from the first one. Now, I don't know whether we're different, or the world is different, or the church is different, or...
Your sons are different?
Our sons are different. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the sons are different. And I'm very happy with both of those things that have happened. Now, I think there are a lot of families like us for whom the children are being given choice. But the most important thing is, if my religion if my spiritual life is of any value, then it comes through in all other ways rather than the institutional ones. And if they want to go to where I get my stuff, then they'll go there. That may be somewhat of an irresponsible attitude for a priest to take, but that's the one that seems to be making sense to us.
Anne and I, my wife and I, were a lot more straight than you and Jane in that process. We did expect, we have four children ranging in age from 17 to 10. We did expect our kids to participate in our religious school and Hebrew school, whether here or elsewhere. We did expect them to go through the rites of passage. We also encouraged them to grouse all they wanted about it. We supported their grousing. We identified with them when there were times that they did not feel that what their experiences were particularly positive. But we also didn't operate in a kind of ossified way. If the kids were under some significant pressures, if the kids were tired, if they had the grandparents coming in, they knew that that was very important for us because family is a basic tradition in Judaism and concern for their best interests is. Also, and so they did not attend class. Each of my kids, my two older kids, Josh and Rachel, have already become confirmed, which occurred at the age of 15. I felt exceptionally gratified that each, in his or her own way, had learned the lesson of what confirmation was all about, and that's, it's tough to be a human being. It's grand to be a human being, but to be sensitive and responsive and understanding to other people and to self, which for me is the basic message of confirmation, not shared by many, they learned that. Now, when Ann and I have had four kids going through a religious school, we haven't had a year when 50% of them were happy. But that doesn't matter. That was a commitment that we expected of them. And although I think in some ways... Because we talked about when you asked the question before, Terry, there is a sense of continuity that is very primitive in people when they become parents. and they need somehow or other to have a sense that their children are doing what you did when you were a child. And if your grandparents are still alive, then you can say, look, Grandma and Grandpa, look what your grandchildren are doing. They're the same thing that we did. And sometimes that becomes more important than whether the kids have a good experience or not. It's that sense of primitive emotional and family continuity that I think is very much tied up with people's fear of mortality.
If your children at the age of whatever age, just, you know, like when they don't live with you anymore,
yes,
if they decide to really abandon the religion altogether and to not practice and not observe or anything, will you feel personally either hurt or upset or angry or like somehow
I love failed? My children. I trust my children. I hope that my wife and I have been somewhat successful in nurturing the sense of freedom within them. However they wish to go, it is their life that they have to lead. I hope that they will share their thoughts and feelings and actions with us, but I would not want to sit on them. I would encourage them and give them my blessing.
Okay.
Well, I think that maybe we didn't answer one. I didn't really answer one little piece of your question also. I think that a lot of people right now are interested in these kinds of things. And therefore, to some degree, when there is a creative synagogue sitting in Broomall, or if there's a parish church or somewhere, the leadership of those parishes, I think, is starting to realize that families are after something like this more now than has been true in the 70s. And that may be because there's a lot of anxiety in the world. It may be because people are understanding a bit more about the importance of family again. We certainly know that's true. And therefore, the family is not all sufficient unto itself always to solve all of its rites of passage and all of its conflicts. And it needs some other kind of way to celebrate its own self. And therefore, the institution of the synagogue or the church are just ideal as the arena for those things.
The fact that we've come through more than a decade of significant discontinuity would indicate to me that people are now really again trying to get in touch with basics. Mm-hmm. And one of those basics is that however you want to redefine the family still does remain a very solid foundation for emotional and human continuity. So I think a lot of the values in the institutions that were challenged during the 60s are now being redefined and are reasserting themselves, redefined but just as powerful.
Now, if you extend that politically, that's where a lot of people start to have serious differences with organized religion, because you can extend the support of the family into opposition to abortion, homosexuality, sexuality outside of marriage, and other related issues.
That's part of the redefinition he's talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, do you want to go into that?
What
does your religion say to you about that, and what do you...
Of course, at St. Mary's in West Philadelphia, we are a very atypical church from that standpoint. We're gay and lesbian people and people working on relationships outside of marriage and people who are working on all kinds of political issues, including abortions and other sexual political understandings, feel very much accepted and are a part of the life, celebrated life there. And the answers aren't in yet for any of those things about what new kinds of expressions we should be finding in the religious life of the parish. But it is an all-inclusive congregation at the moment with a lot of acceptance. Traditional parents with children do not feel uptight about a couple of men who are living together sitting in the pew with them and walking up and getting the communion together and being real brothers and sisters in the faith. And I'd say that's atypical. I'd say that's not happening a lot, but it can happen, and we are finding that that is possible. I don't know whether there are many synagogues where that is happening yet.
So for you, there's space for both here. There's space for religion to help the family celebrate its rites of passage and celebrate itself, but people who choose other other lifestyles are equally welcomed into that religion.
Well, and they can be affirmed with equal validity and equal strength. We do not have to measure them qualitatively with the family as the norm. That's what that's the really painful thing that we are all exploring. I mean, I'm a family man, and how do I relate to the young unmarried who will never be married? Out of almost a commitment now, she or he mm-hmm. are not only homosexual, but do not want marriage or do not want children or other kinds of options.
I operate with the principle that I shared with you before, that each human being is in God's image. And because each human being is in God's image, that individual is to be loved and is deserving of love and is worthy of love, whatever the lifestyle or choices the individual would make. I don't think in our congregation, in a open, accepting way, some of the things that you've identified, Ralph, have happened. I have had young adults in our congregation come out as gays with me before they will with their family mm-hmm. and feel more comfortable with me before they go to their family.
Sure.
Some of the things that our congregation is becoming more accepting of, I would say, would be alcoholism. Would be the whole drug scene, would be the kind of challenges of single parenting or things like that. Those are more typical of what's going on in our congregation than some of the things you've identified
sure.
at yours.
Sure. How about living together without marriage? Is that happening more in the suburban setting now?
I don't know whether it's happening more or not. Many of the young couples I see have been living with each other for quite a long time, some who we would be seeing for purposes of marriage. My sense of it is that what I have found with couples who've lived with each other before marriage is no indication of what's going to happen when they're married, that there's very little hard generalizations you can make. I know couples who live with each other for 5 years and they were scared out of their gourds at the time of the wedding ceremony. And a couple of months later, they were divorced because they couldn't hack it. Somehow or other, the notion of marriage meant something far more significant than living together. Other couples who've lived with each other moved right into marriage, and there was no significant transition at all.
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce both of you for our listeners who are just tuning in now. We're talking about religion, and I have two guests with me, Reverend Ralph Moore, who is a frequent visitor to Fresh Air. Ralph is a priest of the Episcopal Church and is the director of the Christian Association located on the Penn Campus. With us also is Mayor Seligman. He's a rabbi with Temple Shalom in Broomall, and that's a Reformed temple. Do people expect you to be real holy since you're an official member of the faith, you know, you're clergy people.
There's one story that came to my mind when you asked me that, Terry. I was once talking to my nephew, and I was wearing my white robe for the high holidays, and he said to me, "Mayor, why are you wearing the white robe?" And he said, and I said, "Because that's supposed to make me pure." And he said, "Pure what?" So I found that to be a rather humbling experience, though I never perceived myself as holy. Within the framework of Reformed Judaism, I don't think those kinds of expectations are placed on a rabbi in a ritual or in an observant sense as they are within Orthodoxy and Conservatism. I do think, however, that people do look to leadership for role models and ego ideals. And I think that because that's an inescapable reality of being a clergy person, then you have to be very, very sensitive to how you want to come off in that area. I used to fight a lot not wanting to be a father figure. And then I recognized that however much I would want to fight against that wouldn't make much difference because that was going to be invested in me. So now I'm concerned about how can I be the best parenting figure. Mm-hmm. And that's the focus that I'm working on. And I want my life to demonstrate that, not my words alone. Mm-hmm. And I can't get out of it, so it was a matter of creatively understanding its need and then understanding that need, how to work with it in a positive way.
That's a fine statement. I like that, the parenting figure. Like it or not, those of us who've taken on some kind of ordination, and for us it is a bit different from the rabbi who in a parish, especially a priest in a parish, who has all of the things, I mean, the who is dispensing the word, interpretation of the word, his kind of teaching function, the sacramental function, which assumes a very, very holy, mystical identification, and then the pastoral and the other kinds of daily life in the parish. When I'm functioning at St. Mary's as a priest, I am a bit different from when I am down on the campus as a campus minister. And I'm dressed right now in some fairly ordinary campus clothes, which is what I wear all the time. And people would never know that I'm a clergy person, except within a specific activity in which I was so identified. However, I wear my collar and I wear my vestments and I wear other things which identify me around the parish. I don't think people deal with me, though, now that they know me. I mean, that's what I insist. I want to be known as a human being like everybody else. And let the holiness of the other person be drawn out also. So that if there's anything about me that is of worth, well, then I enjoy it more if I can be create a little loop there and I get some energy back.
I want to pick up on that, Ralph. The major joy that I have in life is being open and being known. So that if I can be open and be known and I can bring that same kind of response from another person, that's a kind of immortality.
Right.
So that if my goal, so to speak, would be to know my soul before I die because I don't believe in an afterlife, then the only way I can do that is by opening myself up.
Yeah.
We're right on the verge of and in the middle of the Christian and Jewish holidays of the season, Christmas and Hanukkah. What are you going to be doing during the holiday? What are you doing during the holiday? Ralph, what is Christmas going to mean to you?
I'm going to look like the most traditional Christian you ever heard of. You know, we have a family, a fire and a fireplace, all the tree and stuff like that at home, and then Christmas Eve around 9:30 or 10, we'll go down to church, and there's going to be a big bunch of food and stuff down there, and Christmas carols will be sung, and then at 10:30, the big high mass. And I'm the celebrant this year, and I will be the celebrant at the high mass with all the incense and all the vestments and everything that we will look like 9th century Christianity, you know. I just love it. It just means so much. And we'll be up past midnight, come back.
It's going to be at St. Mary's Church.
St. Mary's Church. We'll come back and we'll have more family stuff. And then Christmas Day, there's a mass at Christmas Day, which we may or may not go to. That's probably a last-minute decision. The Christmas Eve mass is the big one for us.
Mm-hmm. So. Mayor, what are you doing during Hanukkah?
Well, Shabbat last Friday night was also the first night of Hanukkah. So at our Shabbat service, we had a Hanukkah service, and our kindergarten through third graders put on a marvelous presentation of Hanukkah, each in their own way, in an age-specific way. And we had about, it must have been close to 400 people who came to share in that. So that was the official part, and because it coincided with Shabbat. Actually, Hanukkah is really a home celebration, and over the years, my kids have each acquired their own menorah, his or her own menorah. So we have been lighting in a very traditional way all four menorahs each night of Hanukkah, and my wife has made potato latkes, which really have become a tradition for Hanukkah. I've been trying to resist giving my children a gift a day for each of the 8 days because I really think that that's part of the commercialization of the whole thing, which we're all involved with right now. And we've sung some Hanukkah songs. And it is a very family-fulfilling experience. And I love it. As both Ralph and I are saying, very important emotional and familial fulfillments that come through varying ritual observances, whichever ones he would choose with Jane and the kids and I would choose with Anne and my kids.
Well, it's one thing that's really coming through here clearly about how you observe the holidays, and that is with great pleasure. You both really enjoy it. Yeah.
Well, I think religion should be fun, and I should think that it should be pleasurable.
That should be entertainment of the finest order.
Absolutely. I lament the way, especially and speaking as a Christian, I can say this for everyone to hear, I hope. I lament the way that Christianity has become, for so many millions of people, a source of guilt, of dread, of dark mood, of oppression, and, as far as I'm concerned, then injustice and death. It should never be allowed to do that. It's all a celebration of the light. That is something that we all have in common, the birth of light, in however many ways that can be manifested. Well, that has to bring an uproarious peal of laughter and as much good sound, and it is supposed to be enjoyed, and that's why we eat. All the great festivals of all the great religions have food involved in them, which is pleasure, taste, texture, smell, everything. Should be fulfilling in every sense. I can't see any escape from that.
Agreed.
I think it's a really beautiful note to end on. Oh. Well, I want to thank you both for being here.
Let's hope that 1980 and the decade that's to come can be that way. See, that's the kind of religion I would like to explore and to share with people in the next decade.
Well, do you think it's going to happen? I mean, do you see any changes in the 1980s? One way or another.
I hope that the sense of joy and hope and optimism and renewal, which are so fundamental to both of our faiths, will be there. But I think we got some really cloudy days to get through first, but I think we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Agreed.
I want to thank you both very much for being here this afternoon. Maybe we could do this kind of thing again sometime. It was really interesting to speak with you.
Well, we'll come back for a visit come to next season. What's that?
We'll make one up.
Okay.
I've had two guests, Ralph Moore, who joins us pretty frequently here on Fresh Air. Ralph is a priest of the Episcopal Church. He's the director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus and holds Mass at St. Mary's Church. And we'll be doing the Christmas Eve Mass at St. Mary's Church on the Penn campus.
Our rector will be preaching. Add that.
Okay. And Mayor Seligman has been with us. He is the rabbi with the Temple Shalom of Broomall. That's a Reformed temple in Broomall. And we've been talking about how they relate to their organized religions and how they have developed very personal relationships within their religion. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2, we'll be joined by Peggy Anderson, the Philadelphia-based author of the best-selling book, Nurse. So she'll be with us tomorrow at 2. At 3, we continue the series on public perceptions of doctors and lawyers. And at 3:30, Francis Davis will join us for this week's edition of Interval. So I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Danny Miller and John Swed. Technical direction this afternoon was provided by Joyce Lieberman and Paul Keller. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller, and my name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. Thank you. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Ira Flatow with All Things Considered.
Lessons, bitter lessons people learn are don't put nails in your mouth if you're a carpenter. Don't drink a can of soda out here, it'll freeze to your lips. I said one nice thing about the South Pole, the wind is always out of the north.
No guessing.
No guessing.
Another lesson, keep your batteries inside your pocket while your tape recorder's running. Ira learned that lesson when he went to Antarctica last month. Tonight on All Things Considered, a visit to the South Pole 50 years after Admiral Byrd made the first flight.
Also tonight, these stories. The State Department says military action is not next step in tightening screws in Iran.
Foam insulation in your home. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has received 500 health complaints. The Senate has started hearings.
The Mideast negotiator Saul Linowitz is optimistic on West Bank autonomy talks.
The Senate agrees to help out the Chrysler Corporation. It passes over a $1 billion bailout bill.
Beauty product maker...